We're back to Job 16. A number of years ago, not that many, but I was called on to represent a young man who had been charged with the criminal offense of illegally and knowingly possessing a firearm. That's just a fancy way of saying the guy had a handgun. That's not the worst thing you can be charged with in the state of Texas. Everybody has a handgun. I think if we asked people right now to stand up, if they were packing, we'd be both amazed and a little intimidated. You know, Ken Sarles, who used to co-teach with us with me before we passed away several years ago, Ken was this really sweet guy, very professorial, and always packed heat. When we'd go to a movie or we'd go any place else, I always knew I was safe because Ken was going to gun down anybody who looked at us cross-eyed. But this young man had a handgun, and what made his situation a little more difficult is he was a convicted felon. So all of a sudden, it's not just kind of some misdemeanor, it's something that gets you in prison for 20 years. He had been stopped driving a car in a bad area of South Dallas. I don't think there is a good area of South Dallas, but a bad area, a high crime area in South Dallas. The police had found a reason to search his car. I didn't agree with the police. The judge didn't agree with me. In the event of a tie, the ruling goes to the judge. And we found ourselves, he insisted to the police, it's not my car, it's not my gun. Oh yeah, they've heard that one. Eventually, we found ourselves in trial. And the state goes first in trial, and they called the police officers who stopped the car and arrested the young man, and they talked about what a terrible high crime area this was and how dangerous things were in that area and how handguns were such a problem in the area. And they stopped him, and for their personal safety, they searched the car, and look, here's the gun. Everybody went, ooh, it's a gun. And they said, and it was loaded. Here's the bullets. Ooh, there's bullets. So car, defendant, gun under the passenger, under the driver's seat. What more do you need? Well, it was our turn. And I only had one witness. It wasn't the young man. It was his 85-year-old grandmother. And let me tell you something. Family doesn't make that great of witnesses because juries and judges kind of think families will do what for each other? Yeah, lie. So in when credibility is involved, families are kind of right down there at the bottom. You know, everybody can find a mother, an aunt, an uncle, a step-parent who will come in and say something nice about him. I've had a couple who couldn't, but that's... This 85-year-old grandmother was a feisty little woman. She lived down in that neighborhood, walked with a cane, little black woman. She walked with a cane. In fact, when she went up to the witness stand, the bailiff, in a gentlemanly gesture, got up to help her, and she about took his leg out from under him. So she began to testify, and we were walking through what happened. And she explained that on the night in question, her arthritis was killing her. She had a prescription to be picked up at a local Walgreens. She could not drive because she just couldn't walk at that time. She called her grandson to come over. He just lived a couple houses away, that he took her car and was stopped driving her car. And I said, well, how about that gun? Oh, that's my gun. That doesn't sound that believable. I said, why do you have a gun? You're an 85. She said, because the police don't do their job. She said, we all have guns. And I thought, she's right. They all have guns. And the jury's going, oh, that's kind of sweet. But there's nothing that really made her testimony credible. I mean, it was a nice story, but it lacked that hook. And then I said to her, ma'am, because I knew the hook. And I said, ma'am, was that gun just kind of shoved under the seat? She said, oh, no. I had it wrapped up in a plastic Minyards bag. Only she said it Minyards. I'll never get that. In my Minyards bag. And I said, why would you have it wrapped up in a Minyards bag? And she said, well, I didn't want it just sliding all over the place. And I didn't argue with her. I didn't say, well, you know, if somebody actually stopped you and you needed to pull that gun, drag it out from the, they're not going to wait till you drag it out from under the seat, unwrap it out of a Minyards bag, and then shoot them. I didn't do that. But you know, all of a sudden that had the jury's interest. They hadn't heard about a Minyards bag. They just heard about a gun under the seat. And goodness, if that was true, well, maybe this woman knew what she was talking about. Maybe this really was her gun. Maybe she had never told her grandson. She got off the witness stand, and I recalled the police officer who had searched the car. Of course, witnesses can't stay in the courtroom while other people are testifying because that would allow them to craft their or change their testimony. So the officer came in from where he was waiting. I said, officer, I'm not going to go through all the details with you, but you searched the car. Yes, I searched the car. Police officers get kind of irritated. And I said, and you found the gun? Yes, I found the gun. And I said, well, officer, was the gun in a carrying case? Was it in a gun bag? No, it was just laying under the seat. I said, all right. I said, you would remember that? Yes. And I said, well, officer, you prepared an arrest report? Yes. And I said, in fact, you testified from that report earlier? Yes. And I said, that report is an accurate recollection of everything that happened? Yes. So I walked up and I handed him this. And I said, is this the offense report, the arrest report? He said, yeah. I said, would you turn to page 3? And I saw the district attorney going to page 3. And I said, do you see what I highlighted about 4 lines from the bottom? And his eyes went down. He said, yes. I said, would you read that? And as you read, I saw the red going up. And I said, no, officer, would you read it out loud so everyone in the courtroom can hear you? And he said, a handgun was retrieved, wrapped up in a Menards bag under the seat of the driver's. I said, so there was a bag, it was wrapped up, and you never mentioned that to anyone, did you? No. You never told the DA that, did you? No, it was in the report. I said, okay, it was in the report, but you didn't tell anybody that, no. And all of a sudden, the jury went, aha, she's telling the truth. She knows something no one else knew. She knows something only the rightful owner would know. 10-minute not guilty. Sometimes you don't need a lot of witnesses. You just need one good one. Job is on trial. As chapter 16 opens, Job is on trial. Job's problem is he's been put on trial by his 3 friends, and they're not just the prosecutor. They're the judge and the jury and the executioner. He's pled not guilty. His friends don't care. Through 15 chapters, Job has been on trial, and that trial is no closer to resolution than when it began. Through this point, Job has asked for a number of things. If you'll recall, at different times, Job has asked for death. Did Job get death? No. Eventually he'll get death, not in the book of Job, but he'll die. Everybody does. He has asked for a judge, an impartial judge. Has Job received his impartial judge? No. Job has asked for a deliverer. He hasn't received a deliverer. He's asked for a mediator. He's asked for a lawyer. He's invoked that right to a lawyer, right to counsel. He hasn't gotten that. To this point, Job has received nothing that he has asked for. And today in chapter 16, Job adds one more item to his wish list. Job wants a witness, someone who has particular information about Job's case, someone who can vindicate Job, someone who can exonerate Job. Job needs an aha witness, someone who can come forward, tell his story, and his 3 friends will step back and say, aha, Job is right. He's not guilty. Job will get that witness. But it's not going to be in chapter 16. We turn there today. Now, in chapter 15, last week, you remember, Eliphaz painted a portrait of what a wicked man looks like. Eliphaz said, Job, here are all the elements that a wicked man looks like. He's stressed out. He's impoverished. He's rejected by society. He's anxious. He's fearful. And Job, guess what? That's you. I've just described you. We'll turn to the papyrus encyclopedia, and look, we unroll it, and there's a picture of you next to the wicked man. And Eliphaz said, this is what wicked men have always looked like from the beginning of time. Eliphaz says, wicked men have always looked this way. They have always worn black. By the way, you know where the practice of wearing black, bad guys wearing black, came from in pictures? This, you won't find this in the Bible. I'm throwing this in for free. Back in the early 1930s, and I won't ask how many of you were alive then, but back in the early 1930s, Hollywood began to make these B-Western movies, these really cheap, and there was a guy named Tom Mix. I don't know, how many of you heard of an old actor named Tom Mix? Yeah, nobody under the age of 50. But Tom Mix, and Tom Mix was making like one a week. And after the first couple, Mix went to a studio or to a theater and sat in the back row of a screening. And he noticed that the audience had a hard time figuring out who to cheer for and who to boo. And he came back and talked to the movie producers, and they said, all right, let's, I don't know, but the bad guys, let them wear a black hat or a black shirt. And they did that in the next movie. They dressed the bad guys all in black, and they dressed Mix all in white. They went to the next premiere, and everybody cheered the guy dressed in white, and everybody booed the guys dressed in black, and that's where the practice of dressing the bad guys in black came from. Again, that's free. Eliphaz said, Job, you're wearing black. You look guilty, you sound guilty, you act guilty. I don't care what you say, you are guilty. And in chapter 16, Job again responds. Only Job's response to the charge of guilty is a little different. Job says, not only am I not guilty, the reason you think I'm guilty is because I've been framed. I've been framed. If you've ever seen a detective movie, ever seen a murder movie, you know somebody's been framed. Everybody claims to be framed. I can't tell you how many of my clients over the years have claimed to be framed. Sometimes they were, but not very often. Job says, I've been framed. I am innocent, but the reason I look guilty is because someone has manipulated the circumstances of my life to make it appear that I'm guilty. It's not that I'm guilty, but I look guilty. And I look guilty not because of what I've done, but because of someone who has manipulated the circumstances of my life. And Job's frustration is that his friends can't see this. Job can see this, but his friends can't see this. And the reason his friends can't see this, we touched on last week, is because they are viewing life from a closed system perspective. Job's friends look at life as a closed system. We're not going to go over all the what a closed system means in depth, but the easiest explanation of a closed system is someone who says life is a closed system looks at all existence as existing in a box, and all existence is a perpetual motion machine. It's an eternal, perpetual motion machine. And so everything just keeps going. There's no outside influence. There's no outside power or authority or directive. A closed system says, look around you. This is all there is. No one is adding to this. No one is subtracting from this. There is no higher power. This is how things work. It's just a perpetual motion machine that keeps on going. This is the prevailing view of existence in the world today. Most people could not tell you that about a closed system, but that is the prevailing view. They don't understand that they're looking at life through a closed system, but that's what's happening. People accept life. It just goes on and on and on. One of the most common examples of viewing life as a closed system starts with an E. What is that? Elephants? No. Ends with an N. Evolution. Wow, somebody ought to be playing that, with Vanna White and Pat Sajak. There you go. Evolution, that is a perfect example of a closed system approach to existence. Evolution says that what is, and it just keeps evolving. It just keeps developing. It's a perpetual motion machine. Creation is a perpetual motion machine that just keeps on and on and on. And we don't have time to discuss all the fallacies of evolution today, but think of how many holes. Evolution is the Swiss cheese of science. It is so riddled with self-contradiction, with internal contradiction, and yet evolution is a perfect example of the fallacy, the folly of a closed system. Now, if the world looks at life as a closed system, Christianity says, no, it's a different kind of system. What is it? Open, yeah. Oh, we're so good at this. Yeah, it's an open system. Closed system, open. Not slightly ajar system, but open system. Yeah, we say that existence is really an open system. And it's an open system because of what? What makes creation an open system? God. Yeah, we have that external force. We have that force that is apart from what we see around us, who is directing, who is influencing, who is mandating. We have that force. That's the open system. Christianity holds to an open system view of life. And you can see the conflict. If life existed within a closed system, cause and effect would be much more easily defined, wouldn't it? I mean, we could look at what how things are and what things aren't and say, okay, this is how things are. That means they've always been this way and they always will be this way. Is that how life works, though, really? No. But cause and effect becomes somewhat more predictable. In an open system, though, where do we have to go? How wide open is an open system? If God is the external force and the external director, how broad are the possibilities? Yeah, infinite. The possibilities in an open system are as infinite as the God who directs the open system. Now, that doesn't mean everything is helter-skelter, because we know that God has established natural laws or laws that govern how things work in his creation. But still, it is imperative to remember that it is still an open system. And Job's frustration is that he sees the closed system doesn't work. He's outside that box. He's in the open system, but he doesn't understand how that works, and his friends can't even see it. Chapter 16 and 17, Rich will be back next week, and he'll be teaching on 17, is a great example of the fallacy of the closed system. Let's look at chapter 16. Job answers Eliphaz, "I have heard many such things," referring to all of chapter 15, "sorry comforters are you all." As my grandmother would say, they're just a piece of work. As my grandmother says, well, he's just a piece of work. Yeah, I guess Job's friends were just a piece of work. Job is reminding his friends that everybody seems to have forgotten two really important factors through 15 chapters. First of all, Job says everybody seems to forget that the only thing I ever asked for at the beginning was what? What did Job want from his friends? Comfort. Job didn't ask for an intellectual treatise on why Job's life was the way it was. Now, Job's gotten caught up in that argument, but Job's been caught up in the argument because of his friends' attacks. And Job says, all I ever wanted in the first place was comfort. And when you and I encounter someone in suffering, it's important that we remember that what they need most from us is comfort. They don't need an intellectual exposition as to, you know why I think this is happening to you in your life? First of all, you're probably wrong. And second of all, that doesn't help them. So when we encounter someone in suffering, it's important to give them what they need most, and people in suffering need some comfort. Second, Job is making the point that his friends had come with the right motivation. What did his friends come to do? Initially, turn back to Job 2:11. Flipping back to Job 2:11, when his friends come, it says, it's describing, the first chapter and a half described all of Job's loss. And halfway through chapter 11, or chapter 2, it says, when Job's three friends heard of all his calamity that had come upon them, they came each one from his own place, Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, and they made what? Appointments to come together to do what? Sympathize and comfort him. They came with the right motivation. When we come to comfort, don't lose sight of what you're there for. When you're comforting, that's job one. And keep focused on what you're there to do. It's more important in those situations that you're comforting than that you're right. When someone's comforted, needs comfort, they don't need you to show up and tell them what's wrong with their lives. Look at verses 3-5. Job says in chapter 16, is there no limit to windy words or what plagues you that you answer? Let's look at 3 from now, right now. Remember back in chapter 15, Job kicked off saying to, or Eliphaz kicked off saying to Job, we don't have to listen to you because you're full of what? Hot air, yeah. Now Job says, same to you. This argument is really devolving. You know, it sounds like three kids on a grade school playground. You know, you're full of hot air, so are you. So's your mother. You know, let's really ratchet it up. Yeah, so's your mama. But here's the question that Job pitches. Here's what's really interesting in verse 3. Look at this. Job says, what plagues you that you answer. I love that word plague. Job says, why do my arguments plague you? When we hear the word plague, what does that describe? Misery. They worry you. They crush you. They bear down. You notice Job didn't say, well, why do my plagues bother you? He says, why do my arguments, rather, plague you? Why do they plague you? If I am full of hot air, if I am just an emotional wreck, what about my argument? Why do you keep arguing with me? That's what he's basically saying. You guys are smart boys. If I'm wrong, and you know I'm wrong, and you can look inside yourself and say Job is wrong, then why do you hang on like a dog hanging on to an old bone and you just keep arguing with me? That's his question. They don't have anything new to argue, so why do they keep arguing? So why are Job's friends still arguing? That is a good question. Job's friends have gone, they've all taken their shot. Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar. Nobody's changing their tune. Job is still saying, I'm innocent. They're still saying, no, you're not. So why are they still sitting around arguing?
Ego,
that's possible.
They want to be right.
Yeah, want to be right. Job doesn't get it. Why is it necessary to defend their conclusion? Why is that imperative? Think about what we've already talked about in the past. It validates them. But what's the whole basis for their attack on Job? Why are they trying to figure out why Job is suffering? Is it for Job or is it for them? It's for them. And why is it for them? They don't want it to happen to them. They continue to argue from the basis of fear and ignorance. They have addressed Job, they've engaged Job, because they don't know the answer. And in a closed system, the only answer they can come up with is, Job, you must be guilty. We have no evidence that you're guilty, so we're going to try to squeeze it out of you. But you must be guilty because that's the only thing that makes sense. They're afraid. They, in their own minds, have not come to the point where they can say, yeah, I can live with this whole closed system thing. Even though Job's saying he's not guilty, he's guilty, let's all go home. They are scared. Can they see Job suffering? Oh, you bet they can. They see Job. Here is a man who, 60 days ago, had a beautiful family. He had all these sons and daughters. Now what does he have instead of sons and daughters? Ashes and graves. They saw a man who 60 days ago maybe was one of the wealthiest people in that known part of the world. What does Job have now? Nothing. They saw a man who 60 days ago had been in great health. How's Job's health holding up these days? Terrible, covered with boils. They look at Job and they see what? They see what could happen to them, and they don't know why. And until they can figure out why, they are stuck at Job's side. Not because they're there to comfort Job, but because they're there to avoid the same fate. If Job's sons and daughters can be killed all of a sudden by a great wind, their sons and daughters can be killed. If Job's property can be taken overnight, their property can be taken. If Job's health can go away and he can be covered with boils, they could be covered with boils. There's got to be a reason for this, and they're going to stay until they find the reason. They're arguing from ignorance and fear, and in a closed system, if you argue with anyone long enough or discuss anyone with anyone long enough who's trapped in that closed system view, it comes down to fear and ignorance. It comes down to fear and ignorance. Look what Job says in 4 and 5. Job says, I could speak like you if I were in your place. If the tables were turned, Job says, I should be shooting off my mouth too. But Job says, I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the solace of my lips would lessen your pain. Job's basically saying, hey, if I was in your shoes and you were sitting on the pile of ashes covered with boils, you know what I would do? I'd be a comforter. Now, do we know for sure Job would be a comforter? We don't. But you know, we always tend to think, do we always think more highly of ourselves or lower than ourselves? Yeah, those of you who are honest said highly. Thank you. The rest of you, I took your names. Yep. We like to think, as we view the misfortunes of others, especially if we're suffering, that, hey, I would do better if I were in your situation. You know, the bottom line is, the life lesson is, purpose to do better. Remember these things and purpose to do better. Verses 6 through 22. Obviously, we're not going to go through each one of these, 6 through 22. Job has already said, I've been framed. The question is, who framed Job? Who framed Job? Somebody had to. And in verses 6 through 22, Job lays out his argument. And it's not a novel argument. Job says, you know who framed me? Who framed Job? No, the devil didn't make Job do it. God framed Job. God framed Job. Because Job begins to address God. In verses 6 through 22, Job talks about God. He says, if I speak, my pain is not lessened. If I hold back, who has left me? But now he, God, has exhausted me. You, God, have laid waste all my company. You, God, have shriveled me up. And on, his anger, God's anger has torn me apart. God has gnashed me with his teeth. Job is blame shifting. Have we ever seen blame shifting before the book of Job? Oh, we saw it a lot. Where did it begin? Garden of Eden. Absolutely. Garden of Eden, right after the fall. God comes down to walk with Adam and Eve in the cool of the evening. He finally flushes Adam out of the bushes and says, hey, you know, nice khakis. Have you been eating something you shouldn't have eaten? And what does Adam say? Well, I'm going to tell you something. And that, you know, when you read this account, I always think of my kids when they were little and they'd be caught red-handed. There was never a yes or no answer. There was always an explanation. And it was, well, I'm going to tell you, the woman, not the woman I asked for because I never asked for her, not the woman I manufactured because I did not make her, not the woman I gave to myself because I didn't give her to myself. That woman who you made, who you put into production, who you introduced into this perfect system, which I always appreciated, she gave me the fruit, and I ate it. So if you want to talk to somebody, talk to, this is really between you and her. I'm not saying it's your fault. We both know it is, but it's a shared responsibility. It's you, it's her, it's not me. And God says to Eve, nice capris. What's this? And Eve said, the serpent that you made. And you let him talk. It's a talking snake. Who does that? He tricked me, and I ate. Yeah, blame shifting goes all the way back. Blame shifting goes to the fall. And Job jumps right in. He says, you know who makes it look like I'm guilty? God makes it look like I'm guilty. Now, and this will be the crux of his argument, from this point until when? When do you think this argument falls apart? Yeah, when God confronts Job. It's easy to blame God until God confronts you. But this will be Job's argument until God confronts him. Now, let's look at it. Has God manipulated the evidence? Has God tampered with the evidence to make Job look guilty? How many think, well, obviously God's tampered with it. How many of you think, oh, no, God's never tampered with it? How many of you think, will we be out by 11:45? Because I can still get to Jason's before the line. Yeah. Or how many boys say, I don't want to be wrong, so I'm not raising my hand. Well, let's look at it. Has God established the circumstances of Job's life? Absolutely. God has established the circumstances of Job's life. That's undeniable. But God has not manipulated those circumstances. God has simply created a scenario apart from the closed system rationale of Job's friends, but wholly consistent with the rationale of an open system. That's the reality. God has created a scenario, but that scenario is perfectly consistent with reality. Because where does reality exist? Does reality exist in a closed system or in an open system? Open system. That's God's reality. Now, we have a very limited insight into that reality. But God has established the circumstances of Job's life, the scenario that's going on, and it is perfectly consistent with reality as it truly exists in an open system. So Job's perceived guilt is not due to God's manipulation. It's due to Job's friends what? Why does Job look guilty? Is it God's manipulated, or is it because his friends can't understand what reality is? It's his friends, yeah. You see, the perception that Job is guilty has nothing to do with the circumstances. It's his friends' misconception of what those circumstances mean. They're trapped inside that closed system. They're trapped, and they can't see beyond it. The problem is, who's the only one who can really understand reality in the open system? God. Yeah, that's where things like faith come in. That's where things like trust come in. That's why it's so important to know the character of God, because only God can understand how things are working out in the open system. It's frustrating to Job, and it's completely uncipherable to his friends. Look at verse 8. Look at how Job's physical condition has deteriorated. Even what? You have shriveled me up. It talks about how Job's looking. He's shriveled up. It has become a witness. My leanness rises up against me. I can honestly say in my life, my leanness rises up against me is never a phrase I've used. And quite frankly, I don't want to go through the testings of Job to get there. I'd succumb to Weight Watchers before I succumb to Job. And I'm not about to do that either. Look at how Job describes God, though, in verse 9. Job is beginning to lose his fear of God, I would suggest. And one of the dangers that we encounter in suffering, prolonged suffering especially, is that we begin to resent God. Remember, Job has already said, God is manipulating my life. God is unfairly manipulating my life to make it look like I'm bad when I'm not, when I'm guilty that I'm not. But in verse 9, what does that sound like? God is a what? He's an adversary. He's certainly an adversary. But what kind of adversary? A predator. He is saying, God is not only not my friend, God is a predator. He's like a predatory animal. Look at that. He hunts me down. He tears me apart. He holds me up. In verse 10, he holds me up to the ridicule of my friends. This is Job's conception of God. Remember what Job said when his wife said, curse God and die. What did Job say? No, God is good. Shall I receive good from his hand and not bad? Now, in the 16th chapter, Job is saying, God is a predator. He hunts me down. He tears me up. He holds me up to public ridicule. It is easy. We are all just weeks of suffering away from this type of attitude toward God. It's so important. The more we know of God, the better we know of God, the easier it is to avoid this kind of a pitfall. Job says in verse 12, I was at ease, but he, God, shattered me. He's grasped me by the neck and shaken me. God has bushwhacked Job. Job was at ease. When was Job at ease? Yeah, back in chapter 1, Job was at ease. In Job 1:1, Job was at ease. Why was Job at ease? Yeah, why was Job at ease? At the beginning of the story, why was Job at ease? What are some of the reasons? He's what? Yep, there's no problems. Family's going well. He's rich. He's respected. People come to him. When things are going well in our lives, it's our tendency to think what? Yeah, they'll always be that way. When times are good, there's a tendency to become complacent and think that they will always be that way. And so it can catch us by surprise. Now, in fairness to Job, even if Job had been alert and wondered, would that have helped him? No, this was happening. But as a life lesson, even in good times, we need to be aware. We don't have to have that doomsday mentality, that bunker mentality, but we need to be aware, even in the good times, to be alert. We need to be aware that our financial situation is subject to change. And so when times are good, what should we do financially? Yeah. Well, be a good steward, and that includes putting aside finances for times when things might be a little tighter. When our health is good, what should we be doing? Be thankful for it. And we should also do those things necessary not to run our health into the ground. You know, spiritually, when we feel close to God, what should we be doing? Seeking Him out even more, drawing closer to Him. You know, in good times, it's easy to become complacent, to think, this is good, I've kind of hit that good time plateau, and it will always be this way. Is life always this way? No. Have any of you ever experienced, now for a time it may be this way, but haven't we all experienced the ups and downs of life? We have. And when times are good, we need to prepare for those things. We need to prepare for those things. Eliphaz in chapter 15 had accused Job of running at God without a sword. He said, you have a shield and no sword. Eliphaz, or Job, says here, that's not true. God is not being chased by me. God is chasing me. Job is saying, your closed system approach is wrong. Here are the weaknesses of closed system. One, it ignores the sovereignty of God. Two, it surrenders control to the individual. And three, the closed system is ruled by our senses. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Yeah, bad thing. Let's wrap this up. Verses 19 through 22. Job says in verse 19, even now, behold, my witness is in heaven and my advocate is on high. Does that sound nice? Is that a statement of fact by Job? Is Job saying, I know I have a witness in heaven. I know that I have an advocate on high. Job is asking for a witness. Is he saying, I know I have one, it's just not here? Yeah, he's not saying, I'm naming that witness. Job is saying, what I need is a witness in heaven. If God is the cause of things, if God is manipulating things, I need an aha witness to go before God and explain what's really going on. But Job says, my witness is in heaven. Is his witness God? Do you think he's talking about God? No. God is the predator. God is the enemy by this point in Job's life. So Job is talking, if he's not talking about God, who's he talking about? An intercessor. Does he even know who he's talking about? No, Job is hoping. Job is saying, I need a witness in heaven. I need someone who has knowledge of all the facts. I need someone who can speak for me. I need someone who will vindicate me, someone who will exonerate me. Will Job eventually get that witness? Yes. And his surprise ending will be the witness, will be the judge, will be the mediator, will be his representative, will be his comforter. It's all the same person. He just doesn't know it. Next week in chapter 17, Job's response continues. Job's friends came to comfort, but very quickly they lost sight of why they were there. It's important when you and I come to comfort that we not lose sight, that we keep our eyes on the prize, and that we become effective comforters. That doesn't mean every time somebody is suffering, we have to find them and comfort them. But on those individuals who come across our path of our lives, we need to be effective comforters. So how do we do that? Here's just a few suggestions. First of all, show up. Show up. Do you know what's worse than saying the wrong thing? Not saying anything. Show up. Don't just read a prayer list and say, well, yeah, that person's in the hospital and they're 8 minutes from me. But you know something? I'm going to keep them in my thoughts and prayers. That's a fallback to I'm not going to show up. Keeping us in our thoughts and prayers. Show up. Suffering tends to breed an attitude of isolation. Don't be afraid to show up. Second, use common sense. If you're sick and somebody's sick in the hospital, should you go to the hospital? No, do not go to the hospital. Find some time that's convenient for that individual for you to call on them, whether they're home or in a hospital or in a rehab. Try to figure out some time that's convenient. You know when it usually is not convenient if somebody's in the hospital? Real early in the morning and real late at night. Think about it. It may not be convenient to your schedule, but you know what else is not convenient? Suffering is not convenient. So think about it. Use common sense. Three, don't say things you don't really mean. Don't say as you're walking out the door, and if there's anything I can do, you just call me. Because that call is going to come sooner or later. And it's better you didn't say it than that you didn't mean it. Don't say things you don't mean. Fourth, talk about things that don't matter. When someone is suffering and you encounter them, don't feel that you just have to dive right into that suffering. Talk about that suffering, and that's all there is the suffering. Talk about things that don't matter. Talk about things that are going on in your life. Let them talk to you about things other than the suffering. What's going on with their kids or their grandkids? What's going on with the job? It's important to remind people who are suffering that there is life apart from suffering. You know, this past Tuesday, I guess Monday or Tuesday, I was visiting Daryl Bennett, one of my fellow elders, in a hospital. Daryl's been in and out of the hospital for the last 4 to 6 weeks. And we were sitting there, and he had kind of a rough night. He's out of the hospital now, thankfully. But he had kind of a rough night, and he was on pretty heavy pain medications, which is usually people prefer that they're on heavy pain meds when I come. But we were talking about things and laughing and trading stories about what happened, things that were going on in our lives. And, you know, it occurred to me that I just didn't realize this, but Daryl loves serving as an elder in this church. We all do. But Daryl loves the business of the church, and Daryl loves to talk about what's going on in the church. And he hasn't been able to be personally involved for some time because of his medical condition. And I said, you know, we've got an elder meeting coming up in about 10 days. Would you mind if we just talked about what we're going to cover? And I'll take some notes, and I said, at the meeting, I can tell everybody what you think. And so we spent about 30, 40 minutes, we were wrapping it up, and the nurse came in, and she said, I'm so sorry, I forgot your pain medication. You should have had this 20 minutes ago. And he said, I didn't even notice. He was reminded that there was life apart from suffering. Talk about things that matter. Talk about things that matter. And fourth, remind them of God's care. Don't judge them. Don't tell them that, you know, they're suffering. Don't dogpile. If God is dealing with them, let God deal with them. You're not God's little messenger to say, you know why you're suffering? No. They don't need to hear that. If God's dealing with them, let God deal with them. Remind them of the goodness of God. Remind them of the character of God. In Ephesians 4:32, Paul says, be kind to one another, tender-hearted. And this is about forgiveness. It says forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake forgave you. But it's so important to remember that when someone is suffering, what they need the most from you and me is a little kindness and a little tenderness. And let's close. And Lord God, we thank you that even in suffering, you are a constant companion. Lord, may we purpose to know you better so that when we encounter the difficulties of life, we don't begin to treat you or view you as the enemy. You're never our enemy. You are never a predator. You are our Father. You are our comforter. You are our healer and our deliverer, and you are our eternal hope. And Lord, when we encounter others who are suffering, Lord, may we inconvenience ourselves for them. Lord, may we seek them out. May we offer them comfort. May we talk about things that matter and things that don't. But Lord, may we always remind them of your goodness, your grace, and your character. And we pray this in your name. Amen.